Were dinosaurs really covered in feathers, or is that claim built more on interpretation than observation? Over the last few decades, feathered dinosaurs have gone from a fringe idea to a cultural assumption. Museum displays, documentaries, and textbooks often present them as an established fact. But when we slow down and examine the fossil evidence itself, an important question emerges. Do the fossils actually show feathers, or are those conclusions being layered on afterwards? Welcome to the Creation Podcast, where we explain how science confirms scripture. I'm your host, Mary Claire, and today we're tackling one of the most debated topics in paleontology, the claim that dinosaurs had feathers and evolved into birds. To help us navigate both the fossil evidence and the interpretation surrounding it, we're joined by ICR paleontologist, Dr. Gabriella Haynes. Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Haynes.
Thanks so very much for inviting me to come.
Yes, well, we have a lot to unpack today, and I would actually like to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background in paleontology and what qualifies you to speak on the feathered dinosaur debate?
Well, I have been working in paleontology the last almost 20 years. Wow. Because of college, you know, studying undergrad biology and then learning about dinosaurs. The area where I'm from in Brazil, it's one of the five best places in the whole world for dinosaurs and pterosaurs and any other types of fossils. And I have been involved with other scientists that have been studying about dinosaurs and pterosaurs and some other types of fossils for many years. So that's one of the things that it helps me to kind of have a understanding of the whole picture, a little bit of the context that is behind all that. So I got my master's and PhD on geology paleontology, and I have been studying deeply this part of feathered dinosaurs for the last 5 years, reading a lot of the literature, checking a lot of the papers, analyzing some of the species and checking their description and all of the details behind the claims. So that's one of the things that I have done the last 5 years.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you have a very extensive background in paleontology. And personally, paleontology is one of the branches of science that I am most fascinated by. And so I am incredibly eager to have this conversation with you today. I'm excited about it.
Let's go.
So before we jump into specifics, I want to start with a foundational concept that will guide this entire conversation. So in paleontology, there's a difference between what we observe and how we interpret what we observe. I know you've talked extensively about lenses and the different lenses that people have when observing this kind of evidence. So from your perspective as a paleontologist, why is that distinction so important, especially in discussions about dinosaur feathers in particular?
Again, we all have a worldview. We all have a way of approaching to things, approaching to the data, and assuming some points about the data. There's no neutrality. We all have a background of information based on what we study, what we have been influenced by, what we have lived in our life, experienced in our lives, school, college, all of that, church, all of those knowledge, they kind of put together like a suitcase and you carry them around in your mind. Yeah. And then it's almost like glasses that you're going to go and see things through. So when you see a dinosaur, as a creation scientist, you see a dinosaur and you see as the result of Noah's flood, a global catastrophic flood. A scientist that it's not a creation scientist, they're going to see the same fossil, the same data, the same fact, in as a result of millions of years. Yeah. There is no global catastrophic flood, and there's no way of knowing that it's only 4,300 years. So that's one of the points that we have to see, is we can have the same data, we can have the same information, but have very different interpretation, not only different, opposite. And that's why we have to be aware that we all have a worldview and be aware of what type of worldview I'm applying to the data, to the fact that I'm seeing. The same thing is with the supposedly feathered dinosaurs. You're going to see those dinosaurs, you're going to see features in those dinosaurs, and now you're going to have to read those features through the lenses that you have.
Yeah, it really depends on the person and their background and their belief system. So now that we've laid that groundwork, let's talk about where the idea of feathered dinosaurs, where does that actually come from? When did the concept of feathered dinosaurs begin gaining that mainstream attention? And what discoveries pushed it into the spotlight?
It's very good when we can learn the history, the background, the context of a topic. So when we talk about feathered dinosaurs, that's not a new thing. It doesn't come in the late 1990s. No, it comes way back to Darwin, 1859. So Darwin, he wrote his book talking about the theory of evolution, what he believed that, how he can explain things around in a world without God. So he was doing that 2 years after Archaeopteryx was found.
Right.
Huxley was a big defender of Darwin, so he just embraced the idea of Archaeopteryx as it was a dinosaur with feathers, which is just showing a transition from reptiles to bird.
Yeah.
And then Archaeopteryx became turned into the star witness of Darwin's theory. So that's when it starts. After around 100 years later, all the idea of dinosaurs and birds being related, it was kind of not so strong. But then around after 100 years, someone found, John Ostrin found some bones. He found some bones and he described them as Deinonychus. It's very important for us to understand what Deinonychus is. Deinonychus has a very important role in this whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So, because Huxley wanted to find something to prove Darwin's theory, he was pushing this idea of a transition organism, and then they found Archaeopteryx. They had some features that it was very weird, different for what they believed that birds would have, because they were comparing, oh yeah, it has feathers like modern birds, however, it has some other features that birds don't have. So he was pushing, okay, we found the best transitional fossil to prove the theory, but Huxley is gone, he dies, and after 100 years, John Ostrin finds Deinonychus.
Okay.
John Ostrin found bones that came from different expeditions, and one expedition was in 1930s, and the other one was 1960s. So we had 30 years apart from one expedition to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then those bones were gathered. Those bones also come from two different areas. They're kind of around 35 miles away from each other.
Yeah.
They also come from different layers.
Okay.
Even in the secular worldview, those layers, they represent millions of years between them.
Mm-hmm.
So even in their worldview, it should not be possible.
Yeah.
Even if you say, okay, not millions of years, thousands of years, it wouldn't be possible.
Mm-hmm.
But they put them all together.
Put them together, two completely.
Yes, it was around 1,000 bones. And then you can say, well, but those bones were articulated. They were connected somehow. They were joint. No, they were not. They're only pieces of those bones that were articulated, mainly the tail. The rest was just associated, which means close to each other. They were not connected. They were not joined. They were just around each other. So he gathered all of this, and then he wrote two papers, one in February of 1969 and the other one in June, July of the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And he was describing and talking about this very special fossil that he found, described, and studied, and named. What he does is, in his paper, he says, I believe... He uses the word, I believe. I believe that those bones, I have three specimens. I have no proof, but I have no doubt. So it's a lot about the idea that it's faith.
Yeah.
You're just putting bones that comes from two different expeditions,
mm-hmm.
from different places, from different layers, and still putting them together, it was the same thing. So he comes with Deinonychus, which has some odd features, like some like birds, some like dinosaurs, reptiles. So he has those information. Then he was like, great. So Huxley was correct. when he was thinking about this transitional, this type of animal that has the same features like reptilian features and then bird-like features together. So he brought up that topic to the surface again, and now he was one of the biggest promoters of that type of idea. His student, Baker, mm-hmm. He studied under John Ostrin, and then he's the one that now is pushing the same idea. And then when around the 80s, they change the definition of the word dinosauria, because before, dinosauria was just dinosaurs. Yeah. Like when I say dinosaur, you understand what it is.
Mm-hmm. I can envision it in my brain.
Yes, you can envision in your brain what is a dinosaur. So dinosauria went from that type of dinosaur to include birds.
Oh.
So now when you talk about dinosauria in the secular literature, you're going to find that it's birds and dinosaurs together. So they change the definition of that term. So they keep going, and then it comes in 1950s, cladistics, which is an evolutionary method of classification.
Okay.
That it's based on ancestry and share ancestor. So they're going to go and they're going to support that idea. Yeah, this is correct. Mm-hmm. And then the biggest work was done in 1985 and 86 by Gauthier, when he actually goes and he creates some other terms and change some other terms to include dinosaurs and birds all together.
It's amazing that they just have this authority to just change these terms the exact way that they see fit.
One example is theropod. Theropod, the first term was invented, created in 1881.
Mm-hmm.
That was just theropod, dinosaurs. And then in 1986, Gauthier changed theropod to include birds. So when someone says, oh, this is a theropod, you have to ask, what definition of the term theropod are you using? From Marsh, 1881, or Gauthier, 1986? Because there are different mm-hmm. definitions for the same term.
Yeah.
And that's very problematic in a scientific field to be talking about one term mm-hmm. that has very different definition. So now we think that we're talking about the same thing, but we're actually talking about different definitions. And that's one of the problems. So it comes Darwin, Huxley, Archaeopteryx, John Ostrin with Deinonychus, and Baker pushing the idea, and then Gauthier changing the terms for all of that. So feathered dinosaur, it's not a new thing. It goes all back to Darwin, and it's presenting the whole idea of evolution from one created kind to a different created kind, from reptiles to birds.
It all goes back to that lens, that worldview,
correct.
And the way that you're looking at it and how you're constructing this timeline to fit what it is that you believe. That's so interesting. I want to talk, too, about certain fossil sites. Because when I was doing research, it said certain fossil sites, especially in China, come up repeatedly during these discussions about fossil birds. What is it about China and those fossil sites that all of these fossil feathers have emerged?
Well, China is an interesting place because fossils there, it's a financial thing. So farmers, they can find fossils and they can sell those fossils so they can get some money. So they have people that actually work in the field getting fossils so they can sell the fossils. So of course, if you have some financial reason mm-hmm. to do it, you're going to do and you're going to do more. And that's what happens in China. Just people are working a lot in this field. They're finding a lot of those material. That's one of the things. The second, it's a very well-preserved area. But you're going to have what they call Lagerstätten. It's a term in Germany that they use for places that are very well preserved. But you have that place that it's well preserved everywhere in the continent.
Yeah.
Every single continent that you go, you're going to find the same thing. For example, I'm from Brazil. Mm-hmm. They have one 40 minutes away from my mom's backyard. We have one Lagerstätten also. So it's very important for us to understand that it's not that we haven't found more in the United States. So, for example, in South America, when in Europe, it's just because there are not a lot of paleontologists.
Yeah.
And there are not also a lot of people working to find those fossils and to study them.
So China essentially just has a lot of people who are digging and like purposefully looking for these fossils, and that's why a lot of them are there.
Right.
And that's within the fossil record.
That's correct.
Very interesting. Well, headlines and illustrations tend to jump ahead of the data. So let's slow things down and focus on the physical evidence itself. When paleontologists actually examine these fossils closely, what do they actually observe in the rock?
There are two things. One is it could be a dinosaur that has the anatomical features of a dinosaur, of a reptile. Mm-hmm. And you can see some filaments, some kind of hair strand.
Yes.
Feature right there. And then you have the other option, which is a bird, because you're going to see a feather, just like the modern feathers that we see today, and a creature that it has some of the reptilian features. Why am I saying reptilian like this? It's because they have features that the scientists were not expecting to find in those creatures.
Okay.
So the first point is the one that is a dinosaur. You can see it has the whole anatomy of a dinosaur. However, it has those filaments.
Okay. What are those? What are those filaments? They're not a feather.
Those filaments, they're just kind of a hair strand, a thin hair strand. What has been coming from literature, from studies, from analyses, what those filaments are? Well, they could be collagen, they could be keratin, they could be some skin, just being decomposed skin, and they also could be biofilm. What is a biofilm? Biofilm, it's kind of a mat of bacteria.
Yeah.
The way that they behave, those bacterias, the way that they spread, the way that they're packed together, it looks like melanosomes. So that's why when the people look at some of those material in the microscope, they see it and they were like, oh, this looks like melanosome. So if it's melanosome, so it has feathers. So they call those filaments, as they see melanosomes and those filaments, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's great. So this is feathers. It looks like melanosome, but it's not melanosome. What's the problem with that? There's a technique called TEM, T-E-M, that it's a chemical test that you can do. You can go and test it, and then you can see chemically if it's melanosome or not melanosome. What's the problem? Nobody does that.
Oh, why?
Good question. Because there are a lot of machines. Those scientists, they can find money to go through it. But because they assume already that if you see a filament, and if you see in a microscope a structure that looks like melanosome, that's a feather. So that's one of the problems. However, we have to see that filament, it's now seen as a feather because a change in the definition. In 1999, they changed the definition of feather. Also, the same way that they changed for dinosauria, the same way that they invented, created new terms like Maniraptora, the same way that they added birds in the term theropod, changing from 1881 meaning of the word theropod. So what happened now in 1999 and 2009, those are two main papers about this topic, they change the idea of what a feather is. And why they change that? If you go and you read the paper, you're going to see that they're assuming, they are hypothesizing that evolution happened. And for you to have a feather today, it had to come from something. And it came from filaments.
Oh.
So this is an evolutionary worldview being applied to the data, and they're assuming that because you see a filament, the next stage, the following stage, is going to be a feather.
I see.
So they call it proto-feather, they call filaments, so it's basically the same idea. It's because of evolution, they are renaming, rebranding now when we talk about feathers. And we've seen papers, it's really interesting, because we've seen papers published, something about this gigantic feather dinosaur. And you go to the paper and you look for the word feather, Nothing. Huh. You look for the word filament, it has many of them. Why? Because they are seeing, they're interpreting, any time that you see a filament, that's a feather. That's a proto-feather. So that dinosaur that has the filament, it's a feathered dinosaur.
This is just an insane topic. Just so many intricacies. But like we've said so many times throughout the podcast so far, it all comes back to assumptions. Mm-hmm. So what assumptions are required to interpret these structures as early feathers rather than something else?
Evolutionary assumptions.
Yeah.
That things needed to evolve, and for them to evolve, they have to come from something more basal, more primitive. We don't really use this word primitive, but we use basal, initial, to develop into a feather. So for you to see a branching feather today, it had to go back to a filament. That's just about assumption. That's just about worldview.
Yeah.
It's not about the data. The data is the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's why so many other scientists, they're coming and say, no, this is collagen. Oh, no, this is just decomposed skin. No, this is just biofilm. This is keratin also. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do that, but however, they're not accepting that possibility because they want to keep pushing the idea of feather dinosaurs.
So what makes a feather biologically?
That's a good question. First thing, the branching. Mm-hmm. It has to have branching. It has to have also anatomical components in it that shows hierarchy. That's two things that you're going to find. And then you can say, well, what about proteins in that? Well, the point is, feather and scales, they have the same protein component of keratin. They have the type A and B keratin, and scales and feathers. They have both. So you cannot really go and see if you find keratin, if you find A keratin, this is one thing. If you find B keratin, it's something else.
Yeah.
Because both has A and beta keratin.
So it could be scales or a feather,
yeah,
is essentially what you're saying. Why are these feathers considered highly complex and functional structures?
Well, because of the branching structure, how they work together to support flight and insulation.
Yeah.
So they need to work in a way that it's going to help the bird to fly or to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And those structures, they're very little, and they're still working together. And working together with the beak of the bird.
Uh-oh.
So they can, the bird knows exactly what to do with the feather to make it, to clean it, to preen it, to make it ready for what the bird needs. So the whole structure of a feather, it's to support the flight, it's to support the anatomical feature, is to support the physiological feature, is to support the purpose that a feather was created. And then one thing that I have to point out is that even though a lot has been said about dinosaurs and filaments, dinosaurs having feathers, nothing has been said about dinosaurs having the way of taking care of those feathers.
Yeah.
Because it's not about just having feathers.
Mm-hmm.
It's about taking care of feathers. The reason why birds have feathers is because they take care of feathers. I don't know if you have seen, but so many times you see a bird, they're taking care of the feathers. They're
working. Specifically ducks.
Yes, they're taking care of the feathers all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and there's nothing being said, there's nothing being analyzed about how dinosaurs would be taking care of those feathers. And that's a point that is very important.
Yeah, it definitely is. How are these feathers that we've been talking about, how are they actually found in the fossil record?
Well, they're found in many, many places, in different types of rocks, limestones mainly. They have been found, and it's just beautifully exhibit of a feather.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a feather like modern feathers, and I have seen many of them, even like with bands, like black and white bands, which is it's very interesting because some scientists, they believe that, oh, that's how feathers were. They were just that color, kind of gray, kind of black, kind of brown, kind of white. So you don't see color in them. But you need to see if God is so creative now, if we go to the field and we see animals, we're gonna see them with all sort of colors.
Yeah, all the colors of the rainbow.
Yes, so just beautiful like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that was the color of those animals represented right there. It's just the way of the taphonomic, the type of preservation of the fossil that is displaying that. But you can see the bands and the difference between those colors right there in a fossil record.
Wow, that's so amazing. You know, one of the most odd theories that we have heard about today is that birds today are living dinosaurs. And just the other day, I went and I heard Dr. Hebert speak in the Discovery Center, and he was talking about dinosaurs, and this little kid raised his hand and he was like, "Did you know that birds are actually dinosaurs?" So it's just absolutely saturated in mainstream culture right now.
It is.
So how do evolutionary scientists argue that birds evolved from these dinosaurs, and where does that data actually come from?
Well, first, it comes from an evolutionary worldview that everything needs to evolve.
Yep. We're back to that.
Assumptions.
To those lenses once again, and assumptions.
Yes. That's the first thing. Second, they see now dinosaurs with this structure, which is they call filaments, but because they changed the definition of the term feather, now they fit filament as a feather. And it's interesting because when you go and you check the papers in 1999 and 2009, they talk about a story. And they use a lot the words, "we believe, we believe, we believe." It's basically assumptions.
Yeah.
Relying on their evolutionary worldview.
Right.
So that's why they keep pushing this idea, and they keep using papers and claims like the one that I just mentioned to you, a gigantic feathered dinosaur is found. And when you go to the paper, there's nothing about feathers, but about filaments. So when you go to a museum, you're going to see dinosaurs with feathers now. If you go to secular museums, you're going to see dinosaurs with feathers. Mm-hmm. And even in the Christian community, you know, I was talking to some people and Christians, they have been hearing a lot of that in the Christian community. So it's not just coming from a secular point of view, but a lot of Christians are also believing that this is true, not knowing the background, not knowing the context that carries this idea, the assumptions for a feathered dinosaur.
Yeah, it's in all sorts of cultural mainstream television shows. Recently, I don't know if you watch Netflix, but there's this new documentary series on there called Dinosaurs, and it's all about the evolutionary theories, and there's these basically animations of these fluffy dinosaurs and with feathers.
Movies.
And yes, it's everywhere right now. So yeah, that is just absolutely saturating our culture currently. But there has to be some sort of similarities though, right, between birds and dinosaurs in order for these people, these evolutionists, some scientists to think that they are related.
Correct. There's some similarities in them, and that we can explain some of those because of the shared designer.
Yeah.
So for example, I was reading a book and I liked that author, and I kept buying books from the same author. After some time, I got tired because I kind of could see the design, how he develops the story, and then you just can see a pattern.
Yep.
And you see a pattern in author of a book, a writer, you can see a pattern in people that writes paper, you can see a pattern in people that draw things and paint things. That's normal. It's just a common design that is there because it comes from the same designer. As creationists, we believe that God was the designer. So of course he's gonna have a pattern. He's gonna have information that's gonna be important, because also some of them are developing the same functions. So it's not about a common ancestor, a shared ancestor, but a shared designer.
Designer, exactly. Which brings us back to that creationist perspective. So how do we understand these fossils without invoking dinosaur to bird evolution?
When you see a dinosaur and it has features of a reptile and filaments, that is a dinosaur. If you see a fossil that has feathers just the way that they look today, modern birds, that's a bird. Even though it might have some features that birds today do not present. Mm-hmm. However, if it has feathers, it's a bird.
So do these birds, do they appear fully formed in the fossil record?
Correct. Yes. And they appear also together with some dinosaurs.
Hmm. Well, why is this important for people, especially Christians, to understand the difference between observation and interpretation when evaluating scientific claims?
The Bible calls us to have a sober mind.
Oh, yeah.
We have to think correctly. God gives logic. He puts logic in our mind because He wants us to understand His creation. Because His creation reflects some of His attributes. Psalms talks about that, and some other verses in the Bible talk about the general revelation. And we have to have this mind working in a way that honor God, because we have to honor God with our mind, with our heart, with everything. And that's why Christians, we need to understand what is a fact, what is an interpretation, mm-hmm. that we all have a worldview. We have to understand that we all come from somewhere. And we bring some information to the table.
Yeah,
and
we
to interpret
different backgrounds.
Yes, to interpret everything. So to search truth for truth, for finding truth, because the truth will set us free. It would set our mind free. It would set our eyes free. And we're going to see reality just how it is, the way that God created.
I just absolutely love that so much. And I'm really glad that we got to have this conversation today. This has been a really fun one to dive into. So yep. Thank you so much for your time and all of your wise words. And I believe that our viewers are going to get something super special out of this.
I hope so.
Fossils give us data, but interpretation gives that data meaning. When we learn to distinguish between the two, we're better equipped to think critically, engage graciously, and remain confident in God's word. Dr. Haynes, as we wrap up, what are three key takeaways that you would like listeners to really get from this episode concerning the feathered dinosaur claim?
We have to look at feathered dinosaurs as it has a background. It has a context. It doesn't come from 1990s. It's just not a new thing. Mm-hmm. It comes from a background. It comes from a worldview that has been pushing to try to explain the world without God. That's the first thing. So you look at a feathered dinosaur, think, this is coming from a context of people that they don't want God to be involved. They don't want to submit their mind to God's truth, to the scripture. They don't want to understand that God created those groups in different days. Reptiles were created actually after birds. Yes. It was the opposite order. And even if you want to mix those, it's not going to work, because when you see the order in evolution and the order in Genesis, they're not only different, they're the opposite. Mm-hmm. So in the scientific world, the evolutionary world, you're going to go and see dinosaurs and birds. In the Bible, you're going to see birds and then dinosaurs. So that's the first thing. The second one is they have changed the terms. They have changed the definitions. So every time that you hear the word feather, you need to understand what type of definition they're using for feather. Every time you hear the word theropod, you have to understand what type of definition they're using for theropod. Every time that you hear the word mini rapture, you have to think, hey, this word mini rapture, this grouping was created because of evolutionary ideas. So you have to understand that they have changed the terms, they have created new terms, they have changed the definitions. And the third one is we always go back to the scripture.
Yeah.
The scripture is the authority over our mind. And that's what we have to think. If the Bible is saying this, it's true. And I will trust, even though sometimes we don't know how to explain some things, but there's going to have a day that we're all going to be able to have our questions answered in heaven. So those three takeaways that I want you all to have it.
Mm-hmm. That's something just to look forward to, because there's so many questions here
yes.
on earth that we all have questions about. Just so that's something that I am looking forward to for
Me
sure.
Too.
But thank you so much for all of those key takeaways. They're incredibly fascinating, and I've just enjoyed this so much.
Thank you so very much.
And thank you, viewers, for watching. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, subscribe, and share this with someone who loves learning about dinosaurs. You'll also see our members and patrons' names scrolling on the screen right here. If you'd like to join that community, just click the link in the description. And one of our viewers actually sent in a question for you, Dr. Haynes. So Pastor Robert McLennan said, as a pastor, the number one question that I get is, how do we know that any dinosaurs were actually on the ark? So could you share some of the evidence that we have that confirms that there were dinos on Noah's ark?
Genesis 6, 19 and 20, it talks about which groups of animals Noah should have inside of the ark. That's the first thing. The second thing is, God told Noah that he was going to send those animals to the ark, and Noah had to put those animals inside of the ark. In the group of animals, they have reptiles, which dinosaur is part of reptiles. Mm-hmm. So God gave an order to Noah, you're going to have to put all those animals that I'm going to bring to you, and they're going to be belonging to those groups of animals, reptiles, birds, mammals. Mm-hmm. They would have to be inside of the ark. And reptiles, dinosaurs, it's in reptiles. So right there, we can see that there is an order to put all those animals inside of the ark. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have to think about how big they were inside of the ark. And then we have to think that God was the one sending those animals. Mm-hmm. God is way more wiser than we are. And we know that if you bring adults, they're going to probably die out. They're not going to be able to reproduce as much.
Yeah.
So probably what's happening was God was sending eggs and also juveniles to go to the ark. That's one of the things. The second thing is, we have so many legends all around the world talking about the encounters of people, humans, with dinosaurs, with creatures that we can describe as dinosaurs, but their names were not dinosaurs. The names that were called were dragons.
Yeah.
So we have many legends, many information from different continents for people that didn't have access to each other,
mm-hmm.
talking about the same thing. We have a classic literature talking about also those encounters. So it's very important for us to understand that they were inside of the ark.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that were not inside of the ark, they die during the flood, and then after those dinosaurs, they left the ark. Now they're gonna have encounters with some other people. They're actually a newspaper here in the United States from 1890, just not a long time ago.
Not long ago.
Talking about encounter of someone where a pterosaur.
Wow.
It's not a dinosaur, but it's a pterosaur. It's a reptile that flies. So we have a lot of information from literature, from culture, that points that, yes, dinosaurs, they were inside of the ark, mm-hmm. and that's why humans had access to them after the flood.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for sharing that. I bet that answered his question very well. And thank you, viewers, for watching. We'll see you next time on the Creation Podcast.